Then she goes off, and I wonder where she's gone, and I'm waiting with this baby, and this baby is sleeping right now in my arms, and then it starts to wake, and then I get a little bit, oh, I know this baby's going to be hungry when it wakes up. So then I go looking for this nurse, and I find out that she's not a nurse at this hospital. She's pretending to be a nurse. And then the scene changes because the doctor that is the head physician of the emergency room or whatever it was comes and says, I need your help to start a party for Christmas time.
Oh, that's nice.
And he asked me to oversee this party. And he wants it to be a grand event with a grand opening, so that when the party starts, he wants something like a trapeze artist jumping into water into a swimming pool. When I'm leaving the hospital to go to his home to take care of this, two young boys who say, oh, we're the brother of this little baby, or this big baby, and they say, you need to care for us now too. So I take the three boys, these three children, and with me to this doctor's house to start preparing for this party. And then that's the end of the dream.
You're a very complicated person, aren't you? Very complicated. What do you want to do with all of this complication?
I came to this lecture because I'm fascinated with Jungian analyzing dreams.
Oh, I see.
And I was just wondering, I find it to be happy and gay and frivolous, but having ties to responsibility. And I like to just hear what the Jungian side would say about it.
Oh. Right, I haven't done the Jungian dream work for quite a few years. Any other Jungian analysts here would like to offer a Jungian? Yeah. There is dream yoga, yeah. Do you want to take the microphone, because this is important?
Really, I have two questions which I truly would love to have answered. One is that intermittent Buddha...
Oh, I thought you were going to give Jungian interpretation.
Oh, no, God, no. Oh, no. Ah.
Okay, well...
I think she should be so lucky that she got three at the end and enjoy Christmas.
Thank you, Andrew, yes.
Truly.
Make a nice big party and enjoy.
One to three, it's good.
Okay, fine. So, okay, so you have...
I don't mean to, that was naughty, but I mean, I think what's fascinating, you beautifully set out the different levels of dream.
Yeah.
And in Tibetan yoga, in Tibetan Buddhism, they have a whole dream yoga, and they have certain simple techniques which help you access certain levels of dream. And I wondered, in the Sufi tradition, are there simple techniques that we could be taught which might help us enter the higher levels of dreaming, or is that in the Sufi tradition something that's left up to the individual psyche in its own evolution?
We surrender to God.
And let God do.
That's it.
Yes.
That's it. That is just the surrender. It's like Islam means to surrender. We just surrender. We want nothing. I always love this story of Bayezid Bistami. When somebody had a dream in which God said, everybody wants something from me except Bayezid. He only wants me. But that's your story of Mahmud and Aziz that you said, with all the elephants and the dancing ladies. He just put his hand on the king. And the way I heard that story was that he put his hands, the king said, anybody can have whatever they put their hands on. And Aziz put his hand on the king. And nobody else had thought of that. And Aziz said, but you are the Lord of all of this. Why should I want any of this when I can have the Lord of all of this? And so when, in this version of the story, when Mahmud died, Aziz became king. Just to want the beloved. I think they say in Christianity, I always love this, seek ye first the kingdom of heaven, and all else shall be given unto you. Because if you surrender to the higher self, it does everything. This is actually in the Sufi tradition, this is, for example, we don't work with the different chakras.
Right.
Because in the heart chakra are contained all of the chakras, and we surrender to the heart chakra. And the heart chakra is king, and the heart chakra does everything for you. That is why it's effortless. Sufism is effortless. We just give ourselves to God, and he does everything. We just sit on the bus. We are lazy, lazy Sufis, you know. Rumi tells this story of this man in this village, and everybody was jealous for him because of him, because everybody worked hard apart from this young man. He never did anything, and he always got what he wanted. Because he was surrendered to God, and what God wanted was what he wanted.
And the story at the end of the Mathnavi, which Rumi tells, is that the father leaves his fortune to the laziest of his sons, and the three sons have to prove who was the laziest. It's a hilarious story.
See, look at, you know, we have a small retreat center, and when people come, they say, you know, what are the practices we have to do, and what is the work schedule, and what is the garden we have to dig? And somebody says, well, the beach is over there, and the meditation room there is, and the coffee shop is there, you know? To want nothing of God but God. If you can live like that, then how can you go wrong? How can you go wrong? But we are brought up in the West to want so many things. And when we get to the spiritual part, then we want spiritual things. And we want techniques and practices and dreams, and it all becomes a wonderful spiritual maya we create for ourselves. And, you know, personally, I think, enjoy this maya, you know. The beloved has taken so much pains to create this beautiful world of illusion. Mrs. Tweedy always used to quote the Lord's Prayer, lead me not into temptation. Says, why should he lead us into temptation? But his world, and the beautiful women, and the men, and the music, and everything. Enjoy this world of maya for his sake, but create another one, a spiritual maya. You know, it is much more hard to get rid of spiritual maya. If you knew how difficult it is to deconstruct a spiritual illusion, it is really, really difficult. That is one of the reasons there comes a time on the path when you need to have a teacher. Not necessarily at the beginning, because you need to have somebody who stops you constructing spiritual illusion. You can, it's very interesting, I realized, you can actually, if you have done a certain amount of spiritual work and you have access to a certain amount of spiritual energy, you can construct a spiritual illusion that is very, very similar to spiritual state. And you can live in it. And it can even almost give you experiences of bliss, almost experiences of ecstasy. You don't know the difference because you can't discriminate. And I think it's very dangerous, because nothing actually changes. Real spiritual things evolve. You go through these different states and stages, and things come and go. We call it the yo-yo syndrome, for example, you know. Some days meditation is wonderful, you are near to God. The next day God doesn't exist, and you can't meditate, your mind is like crazy, you just have problems, just little self. And spiritual life, as far as I understand, is very dynamic. It is always changing. And if you are in a spiritual state that doesn't change, unless, of course, it is a state of great, deep peace or something like that, then be careful. Baisab, my sheikh, he used to say of his house, this is a house of drunkards and this is a house of change. Everything changes. I have found, for example, recently in the last year, I had to give up so many spiritual ideas I had. suddenly they became redundant, suddenly they became obsolete. And people's dreams began to change, and the whole dynamic began to change. Things came together that before were kept separate. On the material plane, things change more slowly. In the inner planes, things change more quickly. And one of the reasons that we work with dreams on our path is to attune ourselves to what is happening before it comes into reality. Most people are hit by events when they come into reality. And then you have to kind of do the best you can, and you bounce off them, and you have sometimes crisis. But what the yogi and the mystic has long known is that events first constellate on the inner planes, in the invisible world, and they come slowly into manifestation. It's why, for example, you can have a prophetic dream that maybe takes years before you live it, and then suddenly somebody in our group had a dream 3 years ago, and which was about a Sufi meeting in a building. And only when she came here and went into Merrill Hall, she realized this was the building. Because somewhere, something, 3 years ago, even before Andrew thought of this conference, something had become constellated. Some idea had formed. And through working with dreams, you learn to become attuned with things before they can before they come into manifestation. So you can go with the energy of life as it flows into life. You don't have to bounce off all the changes. The more you go on the path, the faster things become, the more quickly you have to change. What was Vaisab said, for example, he said, some days he will be packed and ready for a journey, and then at the last moment, he will get instruction not to go. And you change and you drop it. And what had been important one day, the next day is irrelevant. There is, for example, as you progress through the stages, one of the interesting things is everything you need for one stage of the journey becomes an obstacle on the next stage of the journey. All the attitude, even the practices that took you to one stage. For example, there is a stage of where you come to renunciation. You have to give up, and you have to give up, and you give up, and you give up. And once you have passed that stage, you are not allowed to give up anymore. It is dangerous to give up. If you stay with the idea of giving up, you constellate an obstacle for yourself because you are caught in the idea of giving up. And that is why the real Sufi says, renunciation of renunciation is renunciation. The great Junaid, he said, the first step is to remember your faults. The second step is to forget your faults. And the third step is to forget yourself. And working with dreams, you learn to work with things before they happen. And I think this is very, very valuable. It is, you tune in to the energy before it comes into life. And so you can go with events as they constellate, as they come together. And as I remember, particularly important spiritual changes, important spiritual events, they constellate on the inner planes long before they come into life. And so you are ready for when it happens. You are ready for the changes as they come. And of course, you learn to be guided. You know, and I think we need all the guidance we can get. It is really very precious. Yeah? Do you want to speak to the microphone?
When we say that we are learning to be guided, I think when we are in a Sufi gathering, when we share dreams, we slowly learn to listen from the heart. We are so used to listen from a different place, but when you listen from the heart, you are coming into another kind of listening that allow you to come to into your dream in a completely different way. And that's the part of the surrender, and that's the part that takes you to the heart, that connects you in a completely different way.
And remember, the heart sees the whole picture because the heart belongs to oneness. The mind, the very nature of the mind is it only sees a fragment, it only sees a little bit. And part of the Sufi tradition is this learning to awaken the ear of the heart, the eye of the heart, because it sees the wholeness. And I always remember years ago I gave a workshop in New York, and it was a very rainy day, and there were only five people came. And one of those five people was what I only call a big black mama. And as I gave the talk, it was very encouraging because she would, every 5 minutes, she would say, "Oh yeah!" And, "Oh Lord, oh yeah!" And it was very encouraging. And at the end, one of the other five people asked a question. And they said, "Look, you know, you talk about inner life and outer life. How can you bring the two together?" And she decided to answer this question. And she said, "In your heart, there is a map that was put there before you were born, when you were in paradise. And if you go into your heart, you will find this map. And when you open this map, you will find it fits into the maps of all those around you. And it becomes part of one big map of the map of life." And that is so true. It is there in the heart, this map of our own destiny, which is part of the destiny of all of life. And when we live it, then we are in tune. Then our note is heard. Because it is heard not just on this level, but on another level. And other people who need to hear that note hear it. Whether they are next door or 1,000 miles away, it doesn't matter. They hear it. They hear it with the inner ear. It is very beautiful to see. Human beings are so beautiful. And when a human being begins to listen with the heart, then many things begin to happen. Because then there is a space for the inner world to come into the outer world. And I personally think part of the, I don't like to say tragedy, but part of the difficulty of contemporary life is we have closed the inner world off from the outer world. They are divided. And they should come together, because then they flow naturally one into the other. And working with dreams is working with the energy of the inner world as it flows into the outer world, and the outer world flows into the inner world. That's why I go back to that saying, "I have placed my signs on the horizons and in themselves, so that they may come to know that which is real." And it is this relationship of the signs on the horizons, which is in the outer life, the signs of God in the outer life, and in themselves the signs of God in our own hearts, and to bring those together, and to learn to read the signs of God. We as a culture have forgotten how to read the signs of God. We don't even know what the signs of God are. And the signs of God have always guided humanity. And this is the only culture, I think, since the beginning of time, that hasn't been guided by the signs of God. And the signs of God often speak in dreams. You know, in some tribes in Africa, if somebody had an important dream, the whole tribe would enact the dream. Because they knew it was important. They were guided by it. We have forgotten how to read the invisible world, so we stumble around in the dark. Because the guidance of humanity has always come from the invisible world. There was a time in other societies where if a child had an important dream, they would be taken to the shaman, and the shaman would interpret the dream and tell the child what the destiny of the child's life was. What happens now if children tell a dream? It is a nice story. They get a pat on the back. So we have lost touch with this whole inner dimension of ourselves, and we need to reclaim it. And much of it is just by listening, just by opening our ears. Just to say yes. But also remember, friends, dreams are illusions. I don't know why I go back to that, but dreams are illusions. Dreams are not the answer. They are signposts You should never mistake the signpost for the road. Dreams have to be brought into the substance of everyday life. They have to be lived. The alchemists called this the rebedo, the reddening. They have to be made part of your life. You have to be prepared to pay the price for your dreams. Yes, my dear. Just wait to get the microphone.
I made a lot of changes in the last 15 years when I started on a spiritual journey of a different kind than until then. And it took me back to my place of origin in Germany many years ago. And my dreams then were centered mostly there. And as I was progressing, I was doing most of the things were taking place now in the dreams. And I find lately I've been able to pretty much record almost one every night. They're very short. And they're taking me back, most of them either to the railroad station of my hometown in Germany, or they have to do with transportation, and they have to do with people in my family of origin. And there are always difficulties. At one point, there is a little baby at the train station, and nobody wants to own whom that child belongs to. I'm trying to find food for it. At another time, there is a car that just won't work. Goes back to the beginning of my first marriage 40 years ago. Another point, I made a grumpy old man in a corner. It says, ran out of memory. And I walk in my hometown, I walk the streets. Things of that type. Another one
too
is...
Too much inner work. You've been doing too much inner work. It's a very contemporary problem. I encounter it with a lot of people. Too much inner work. It becomes a self-obsession and generates more inner work. It is this always searching inwardly for something you can't find. You will never fix it. You can't. It's past. And one of the important things on the path is to leave things behind and to allow yourself to be unfulfilled. We have an obsession in the West for being fulfilled. I think it's almost a paranoia people have. They have to fulfill themselves. Why? Where does it say it? I know you have this wonderful constitution in America that says you can pursue happiness. You have the right to pursue happiness. It never says find happiness. Part of the importance of mystical life is to allow yourself to be unfulfilled. The more unfulfilled you are, the more the beloved can fulfill you. We are all like Hamlet, indifferent, honest. We are not supposed to be perfect. This level of reality is not supposed to be perfect. One of the difficulties is, as you go on the path, you can have a glimpse of another level of reality that is allowed to be perfect. It's called the seventh heaven. It's very, very beautiful there. It is not supposed to exist here. In perfection, things are as they are. In this level of reality, things can fall apart. And as you know, Murphy's Law, they constantly do. And one is allowed to fall apart oneself. And to me, one of the great blessings of Sufi path is one doesn't even have to try to be perfect. There are two ways to attract God's love. Either you become perfect, so he has to love you, or you just offer yourself to God, then he cannot help but love you. So don't try too hard. One of the pieces of advice my sheikh gave us was, if there is too much effort, it's not spiritual. We will never become perfect. We will always be a bit of a mess. It doesn't matter. We're not supposed to be. And that's something in your childhood you can never find. Maybe it can find you when you're not looking. So, don't try too hard. Yes, Lily. Yes. Do you want to speak into the microphone?
All right. I had a dream this morning, and I was in an open place, and there was a table like a stall in a market, and a woman was there, and she put a bowl on the table, and the bowl was damaged. It was like a cloisonné bowl, enamel, and thinking about it now, I don't know whether it was, what country it was from, China, India, Persia. Mm-hmm. Anyway, the bowl was there, and I think I thought, well, I'll have that. And so I think I remember sort of moving it. And then I was upstairs in a building, and there was an open window, and I think I heard Anat say something about some violets.
Some violets?
Violet, yes, violets. And I thought, oh my goodness, you know. And I think I'd put violets in the bowl, either a lot of violets, like a bed of violets, or I thought of a little bunch of violets. And, you were going to throw this bowl away. And
I was going to throw the bowl away.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I leaned out of the window when I heard about the violets, and I rushed to the window. And I think I was feeling anxious. And I looked down, and you were by a bin, and you'd squeezed the bowl so that some of the enamel had actually come away from the metal that it was attached to. And I shouted out, don't throw it away.
Oh.
And you came upstairs, and I say to you again and again, actually, why did you do that? And I said, you know, the bowl was 19th century. It was early 19th century. You know, didn't you see that? Why did you do it? You know, why were you going to, why did you sort of crush it like that? And the thing is, when I first saw the bowl, I knew it wasn't a great antique. But it, you know, it had some age, and it was damaged. It had lost enamel a long time ago, a sort of strip of enamel. But, and also the bowl was not sort of bright. It wasn't a bright colored bowl. It was as if there was some, I don't know, like a veil over the whole thing.
Like a veil?
Well, it was sort of like, maybe the bowl, I don't know, it wasn't really sort of clear, you know? That was it, really. And I each time I said to you, why did you do it? You know, I was speaking louder and sort of stronger and getting more and more sort of indignant and shouting, you know? And well, I don't know how much shouting, but, you know, saying it strongly. I felt very strongly. And then I woke up. And
so?
And I feel quite, I feel a bit, I just don't know how I feel. I feel quite nervous about saying it.
Sure.
And
always difficult to get rid of things.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Always difficult to get rid of things. Is it so important?
Yes, because it had peeled off, you know, some of the enamel had now peeled off, you know, it was sort of crushed. there was also there was a sort of mug or a jug with it later as well.
Yeah. It is very important on the path to try to differentiate what is important and what is not important.
Mm.
And this is something we each have to do time and time again. And one more dream from somebody. And then
thank you.
Reluctant one.
Isn't that good?
Oh, I was saying over there, because we've had this.
We don't dream, but I had this a few days before coming here, so I thought I should probably share it.
That's nice.
I live in the desert off of a highway called 138, the Pear Blossom Highway, and I'm going east on the highway, and there's a white car in front of me, and it's a Thunderbird. And I'm driving, and there's a black car. I'm going east. There's a black car coming from the west. The white car swerves into the neutral ground and hits the black car, and they've agreed to collide and become one. And then there's a white horse. I look to the left, and there's a white horse coming. And then it looks like one of the hubcaps comes off of one of the two cars that have collided, and it's a circle coming in front of my car. All of these cars are really old, also, they aren't new. And then towards me is coming a highway patrol car. And it just has one of those red sirens, like from Highway Patrol or something, and it's black also. And it comes towards me. And so I've passed everything, but I turn my car around and I come back to let them know that I've witnessed what has happened. And that's the end of the dream.
And witnessing what has happened is the white car and the black car crashing together.
In agreeing.
Agreeing to crash together. This is important.
And to become one. And I think for me it was that I was to go back and witness that I've seen that this has happened.